Okay, so we're going to move now to a couple of highly controversial but very important issues that are covered by the fifth commandment. And the Catechism looks at the question of abortion, of course, in numbers 2270 to 2275. And I'll offer you the best wisdom I've got on it, whatever it's worth. Abortion directly terminates life. Okay, we know that. We're talking about a living being whose life is terminated. The zygote, that is the fertilized egg, contains in it 46 chromosomes, the blueprint of a human being, brackets, and this is, has its importance, it's beyond my comprehension, but unless it be more than one human being, as with monozygotic twins. Some think that the individuation of an individual human being takes place 14 or 15 days after fertilization, when a group of cells called the primitive streak differentiates. So we're in an area here, the very, very beginnings of what will develop into human life. Science still hasn't come up with absolute answers for us, I think. There's an area, a little grey area right at the beginning, because when the fertilisation takes place, it's some days this primitive streak differentiates. Sometimes you end up with what's called their monozygotic twins. So the zygote prior to that wasn't an individual human being. It was in preparation for becoming two human beings. Now that seems to be the science of it. The Church, rightly, I think wisely, this uncertainty as to when does human life begin, and it may be, in most cases, right from the beginning, it's the beginning of the development of one individual. But this other creates a little bit of a grey. So uncertainty requires that we consider the zygote human from the moment of conception. It's alive. The only life it has is human life. And it's the very beginnings of it. The developing pro-embryo, and then embryo, and then fetus, is not, in spite of so much rhetoric, part of a woman's body. It simply isn't part of the woman's body. Every other cell in the woman's body has her chromosomal structure. This doesn't have it. This is something formed by hers and the male together, forming this unique individual. So it's actually not part of her body. Though, while in the womb, it is completely dependent on her for life, of course. Not wanting the pregnancy to continue does not justify terminating the life of, or killing, the embryo fetus. No human being is as defenceless as an unborn child, yet none is at greater risk. Statistically, the most dangerous place for a human being in our country is in a mother's womb. A society that respects life will do here we come to some really important. It'll do everything to support the mother during and after the pregnancy, and to provide alternative ways for care of the child once it is born. Adoption is an obvious way, but there are others. There are situations where the life of a pregnant woman is endangered. One example is an ectopic pregnancy. Another is a cancerous womb. In such situations, the principle enunciated above, sometimes referred to as the principle of the twofold effect, when something you do has two effects, you want one, the other happens, but you can't have the one without the other happening, though you don't want it. Do you not get what I mean? There's two. Okay, that principle is to be applied in a situation in which the fetus is not yet able to survive outside the womb, but the mother will lose her life if the pregnancy is not terminated. there is no sense in losing both lives. If, for example, removing a cancerous womb can save the mother's life, this is the thing to do. Unfortunately, the life of the fetus is terminated, but the death of the mother would mean the death of the fetus in any case. One's intention is to save the mother's life. The death of the fetus is a distressing effect that is not directly intended. So saving the mother's life is morally correct, and the logic of it is obvious to you all, I'm sure. To allow her to die and the fetus to die through neglect is hardly the moral issue. This is a long tradition, this abortion issue. It's had a long history. Josephus, Flavius Josephus, in the first century writes, "The law, the Torah, enjoins us to bring up all our offspring and forbids women to cause abortion of what is begotten or to destroy it afterwards. If she does so, she's a murderer of her child by destroying a living creature and diminishing humankind." He's a Jew historian writing for the Romans to understand, because infanticide and abortion were absolutely rife in the ancient Greek Roman worlds, many other worlds too. Here you've got the Didache, the first century manual of Christian instruction, reads, and it's quoted in the Catechism, "You shall not kill the embryo by abortion, you shall not cause the newborn to perish." An ancient Christian awareness. This is repeated in the Epistle to Barnabas at the end of the first century. It's repeated also in the Epistle to Diognetus and by Tertullian in the Apologeticus. So it's been standard Christian teaching, for reasons that don't need explaining, I imagine, to you, from the beginning. And, in fact, automatic excommunication is incurred by anyone who procures an abortion. In 1980, the Australian bishops made this, they had a whole issue, and I'll conclude with this, but this is what they offered us for our reading. "To every woman who's had an abortion, Christ offers his pardon and peace." And I personally would know the most beautiful women you could ever imagine who have had an abortion earlier. And they've learned through it, and they've grown through it, and they're very sensitive, and they're very saintly women. So, of course, you understand that. All sin is forgiven, forgivable. And sometimes the pressure on the mother is immense. She's totally on her own, and no one is doing much to help her. I remember myself being most moved by the bishop, I think it was Bishop Goody, in Perth, at the time when this was, when the law was being debated about this, which it always is being. And among all some of the higher clerics coming down with all these big statements about murdering babies and all this kind of thing. And the man in Perth said, and I thought, "You great bloke," he said, "The Catholic Church in Perth pledges all its ability to help mothers continue bearing their child." And I thought, that's the answer. Support the poor girl and help her and all of that. In any case, back to the bishops in 1980. "To every woman Christ offers his, who has an abortion, Christ offers his pardon and peace. They are often victims of fear or social pressure. Many are tormented with guilt at the memory of what they've done. And too few people are aware of this." You all are, I hope, but the dreams that the woman has in later life of, you know, what could have been, it's a most painful thing, but our society seems to just do it. "Tormented with guilt at the memory of what they've done, but Christ preached again and again of his willingness to pardon every sinner who turns to him in true repentance. Abortion is a great sin, but as with every other sin, Christ died to atone for it. He himself told us there's joy in heaven over every sinner who repents. He came to save sinners, and to that company we all belong." That's good to say, isn't it? And that continues. "Abortion doesn't fall beyond the merciful providence of God. God's tender mercies are over all God's works. For once a human being is conceived, It is irrevocably destined for ultimate immortality. I also grew up, many of you grew up, with the thought that children who were not baptized, you know, would kind of go to some place called limbo. Limbo means out on a limb. It was a medieval lawyer's thought up limbo. It's never been church teaching, by the way, but it's stuck there as part of the thing. It's no longer, no one holds it today. I mean, we've just let it go. It's quite obviously, clearly the case that every, once life is given God's love, we've realised. So the child that's aborted, there's no problem for the fetus or the pro-fetus. That's not, because they're embraced by God. So that isn't the problem. The problem is the mother and the people around and all that, that our love must reach out to them. Once a human life is conceived, says the bishops, it's irrevocably destined for ultimate immortality. Abortion denies to a human being a time of conscious life on earth, but does not simply blot it out of existence. Immortal by their very nature, innocent of personal sin, to regret or to be punished for, these little ones go to be cradled in the everlasting arms of a loving God. Isn't that a better way of teaching than what we learned? And we are not forbidden to hope that they may spend eternity with their parents, who, if they have repented and received God's ready forgiveness, will be free to love them forever. We must think like that. Our problem is a society that doesn't seem to understand what's happening when we procure abortion and make it very hard on the woman, often by encouraging it, neglectful of what might happen to her later and of what we're actually doing. That's a bit, I hope not superficial, but quick, but that's the topic as the Catechism deals with it. Another issue that the fifth commandment covers is suicide. Sadly, a growing phenomenon in our communities. Now, I'm quoting often here now an article that was got out by the Inform, the Catholic adult education in Sydney, produced. They still produce it, but it's changed hands in now, and it may be as good, it was very good before anyhow, when Tony Doherty was the editor, and he got Patty Faulkner to produce this excellent little pamphlet, you could call it, on suicide, and I'll quote it a bit because it's one of the best things I've read on it. So she says this, it's in form number 48 and it's 1996 it was produced. The reasons why people's suicide are almost endless. Part of the agony for loved ones is that they may never know precisely why. But there are some recognised trigger situations: family breakdown, poor self-image, the pressure to achieve, physical and sexual abuse, money problems, and unemployment, and any amount of other things. But these are the issues we've got to look at to create a healthy society which doesn't support or suicide. She also writes, social analyst Richard Eckersley sees increases in youth suicide rates as a symptom of Western culture's failure to transmit a sense of belonging or purpose to our youth, as well as a failure of imagination and commitment. The challenge is to have a vision of and work to bring about environments where hope is nourished, not crushed. And again, concern is shown by listening, genuinely trying to understand the person's cares and feelings rather than by being dismissive of suicide talk or by giving false assurances that things will be better. I'll have more to quote from her in a moment. The Catechism writes, 2282, grave psychological disturbances, anguish, or grave fear of hardship, suffering, or torture can diminish the responsibility of the person committing suicide. I learnt as a young man, and the catechism still holds, suicide is a grave matter, so I have to know that it's a mortal sin to suicide. And hopefully, if I was tempted to suicide, that might hold me from doing it. It might hold me from doing it. That's one truth, that's objective morality. The subjective situation, however, is abundantly clear. If I actually did commit suicide, I've committed an absolutely irrational act. So I'm not in a position to listen to the advice. So the church today, it wasn't always this case because it didn't get the balance right. It would say to me, you mustn't take your life. It's a grave matter. It's totally irresponsible, besides what effect it'll have on others. Now, as long as I can listen to that advice and it prevents me, do you see, that's good. If the advice is no longer helpful and I suicide, the church is compassionate, of course, requiem mass, the whole lot, because the person is assumed not to have committed a subjective sin because he or she had got beyond the barrier where reason could inform and have actually behaved irrationally. And so we only have to bring compassion to bear. Now, Patty Faulkner has these things to say. On the left-hand side, these are the fallacies that some of us might think are true. She says they're not, and she puts on the other side what the facts are. So I'll read one and then the other. The fallacy is, people who talk about suicide won't do it. And she says, talk about suicide is a cry for help and needs a response. The fallacy is that suicide occurs without warning. The statistics are 8 out of 10 people give warning signs, however veiled. Well, 2 out of 10 don't, so we've got to be careful, but mostly there are signs. Fallacy. Suicidal gestures are merely attention-seeking. Fact. Not attention-seeking, but attention-needing. Fallacy. Suicidal people are intent on dying. Fact. They want to be relieved of their distress. They don't want to die. They just can't bear the pain that they're having. Fallacy. Suicide is an inherited risk. It runs in families, some people think. Fact. There's no evidence of a genetic link. The higher incidence in families that have experienced a previous suicide may be due to inadequate support networks or young people are following models of destructive behaviour. Fallacy. All suicidal people are mentally deranged. The fact is, those who contemplate taking their own life experience enormous mental and emotional pressure. This should not be confused with mental illness. Fallacy. Suicide is a minor problem among the elderly. No, it's not. Fact. There's a worldwide trend of increasing suicide among older people. This is the age group at greatest risk. Fallacy. A suicide attempt means that the person will always entertain such thoughts. Not true. The fact is, a suicidal attempt is made during a particularly stressful period. If the remainder of that high-risk period can be appropriately managed, the person can get on with life. Now, some of you may know more than Patty Faulkner on that, or more than me on it, but at least there's some thoughts to... And all of this, of course, will be on the web tonight, if I can have time to put it on. It's in hard copy. It's written, so if you want to get back to it, you know how to do it, or if you don't, I can explain. Thank you. And now just a few leftover points from the fifth commandment to complete the lecture. Scandal. Number 2284 of the Catechism is an attitude or behaviour that leads another person to do evil. Jesus, if any of you put a stumbling block, and the verb is scandalizo, hence it's cause scandal. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, and he doesn't just mean children, a little one who believes in him is a Christian, a disciple of Jesus who puts their trust in love and so becomes very vulnerable because they won't be aggressive and they won't fight. They've become like Jesus himself who died. These people, we, if we want to follow Jesus, are actually pretty vulnerable people because we can't meet like with like. So it would be better for you, if you like that, that a great millstone were fastened round your neck and you'd be drowned in the depths of the sea. Woe to the world because of scandal. Occasions for stumbling are bound to come, but woe to the one by whom the stumbling block comes. Scandalon in Greek was in a racing course, and it was there as an obstacle that you had to get over to continue the race. So this is something that makes it difficult for a person because they're scandalised by the behaviour of the parish priest or by the statements that come out from Rome or by a teacher or by a parent or by a friend or by an uncle or by anybody. They're just shocked by the behaviour. Being a disciple, a little one of Jesus, opening one's heart to love others, makes a person vulnerable. To lead such a one into sin is to abuse trust. The next number in the Catechism, 2285, it is especially grave when a person causing the scandal is someone in authority or a position of trust. That's why, for example, in this pedophilia, most of which happens in the home, 90-something percent. But if someone, and that's obviously a terrible business, and it's endemic in a lot of societies, sadly, and the more we know about it, the more unbelievably common it is. And if you were born in a home, as I was, and hopefully you were, you just can't even imagine why anyone would do it. But in rare cases, it's also done by a priest, for example, or a teaching brother, and then, of course, it's much more scandalous because here you're someone in a position of authority within the religious community whom you trust. So it doesn't take me to explain to you how it becomes more scandalous, more shocking. But it is worth remembering, tragically, that most, it's a very small percentage falls into that category. Most pedophilia is happening in homes. 2286, scandal can be provoked by laws or institutions, by fashion or opinion. Respect for health is another issue. There's a few issues here covered by the Catechism briefly. Traffic in drugs is a scandalous practice, says the Catechism, and I don't need to convince you of that. It's dreadful business. Science, another quote, science and technology must be at the service of the human person and not just take a life of their own independent of people. Another quote, transplanting of organs requires informed consent. Transplanting of organs it could be a generous thing, but you must know what you're doing. There's a whole section on respect for bodily integrity and makes statements on kidnapping, hostage-taking, terrorism and torture, all of which are opposed by the fifth commandment. 2297 reads, except when performed for strictly therapeutic medical reasons, directly intended amputations, mutilations and sterilizations performed on innocent persons are against the moral law. We know all that. But then we have countries leading in the West who actually use torture to get information in the name of anti-terrorism. It's absolutely shocking and creates more terrorism, of course. It perpetuates it. The Catechism talks about respect for the dead, on safeguarding peace, and makes statements on anger and hatred. And then there's a section here on avoiding war. All citizens and all governments, says the Catechism 2308, are obliged to work for the avoidance of war. However, quote from Vatican II, as long as the danger of war persists and there's no international authority with the necessary competence and power, governments cannot be denied the right of lawful self-defence once all peace efforts have failed. 2309 reads, the strict conditions for legitimate defence by military force require rigorous consideration at one and the same time, and here it is again, the principles behind the decision of using violence to counter aggressive violence. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave and certain. All other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impracticable or ineffective. There must be serious prospects of success, and the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition. The evaluation of these conditions for moral legitimacy belongs to the prudential judgment of those who have the responsibility for the common good. You could all, most of us, I think, are on the verge of saying war is just hopelessly can't happen because war today is just so dreadful and so destructive. But perhaps we're holding back from utter pacifism because of those kind of principles that we need to keep in mind. Though some of you may be pacifist. 2311 reads, this is the final part of our talk, public authorities should make equitable provision for those who, for reasons of conscience, refuse to bear arms. These are nonetheless obliged to serve the human community in some other way. So there's recognition of conscientious dissent. 2314 reads, every act of war directed to the indiscriminate destruction of whole cities or vast areas with their inhabitants is a crime against God and man which merits firm and unequivocal condemnation. That's Vatican II. The Catechism continues, a danger of modern warfare is that it provides the opportunity to those who possess modern scientific weapons, especially atomic, biological or chemical weapons, to commit such crimes. And the next number, 2315, the accumulation of arms, far from eliminating the causes of war, risks aggravating them. Of course. And 2316, public authorities have the right and duty to regulate the production and the sale of arms. The short-term pursuit of private or collective interests cannot legitimate undertakings that promote violence and conflict among nations and compromise the international juridical order. The fifth commandment also covers euthanasia. What a morning we're having. Okay, some of the principles. This is number 2276 to 2279. Euthanasia is the deliberate hastening of someone's death with the intention of alleviating that person's suffering. That's how we define euthanasia. Euthanasia may be performed by doing something that has the intended result of hastening death. That's what you aim to do. Or by refraining from doing something that would sustain life. It is not euthanasia to withhold or withdraw futile or overly burdensome treatment. My own mother, whom I consider a saint and for good reasons, 85, she fell. She broke some ribs falling down the stairs at a nursing, or not a nursing, it was the Little Sisters of the Poor in Sydney. And So they took her to hospital and they were draining her lungs, you know, because they fill with liquid. And I went in to see her one morning, because I was the one in Sydney, and I was always the one. If Mum wanted sympathy, she'd talk to Jim or someone soft-hearted like Jim or John. If she wanted the truth, she'd talk to me. It tells you how hard I am. Anyhow, she said, the doctor came in this morning and I said, Doctor, I've got three things to say to you. And Mum's a strong woman. She was quite conscious of what you know. One, she said, Doctor, there's God's will. She said, and I don't know God's will. I'm not sure of that. And I thought, good on you, Mum. Because most people I know who are sure of God's will are wrong. And so she wasn't that sure of that. She was willing to agree that it's a complex area. The second is you, Doctor, she said, and she praised the doctor for his good work, and she was thankful to him, and all the one. I could see the third thing coming, but anyhow, the doctor couldn't see it, so he would have gone away. She said, but the third thing is my decision, Doctor, and I'm 85, and I think it's time for me to die, so I'd like you to take the tubes out. So he took the tubes out. He obeyed my mother, which we all did. He took the tubes out, which meant maybe with the tubes in she would have lived another month. I don't know. What, you know, I haven't got any idea. But she took, so that Mum was then taken back to the Little Sisters of the Poor. The nuns were there praying the rosary. The whole family gathered around, and she died within about 5 or 6 days, obviously from pneumonia, I suppose, the filling of the lungs. Died beautifully, died peacefully, but she'd chosen to discontinue medical treatment. You can all do that. You don't have to keep yourself alive. You can let nature take its course. You see that, don't you? And to allow nature to take its course gently is, of course, everyone's right. Well, so it's not euthanasia to withdraw or withhold futile or overly burdensome treatment. I know people on dialysis and they decide they'd had enough dialysis, so they decided to stop. Good on them. They were ready to let nature take its course and gently enter into prayer and communion with God and death, because they believe that death is not the end of everything. Others may make different choices, but to choose that, I hope it's really clear to you, that is not euthanasia. You're not doing anything to make the person die. You're stopping things which are maintaining a level of pain and existence that they don't want anymore. You don't have to stay alive, you know. Most people in the world die when they die. Just because we can pour millions into keeping me alive for another week, you don't have to do it, and I don't have to accept it. It's not euthanasia to administer treatment with the intention of relieving symptoms while accepting that the treatment may hasten death. And in many cases, that's happening all the time with upping the level of morphine, which stops the pain or lowers the pain. And it also has the effect of hastening death, but it's lowering the pain and giving a quality of life to the person who's dying to with their family and friends and their consciousness. And it's a beautiful thing to do, and everyone's doing it. It's not euthanasia. A person is not morally obliged to prolong the dying through use of extraordinary means. Patients have the right to have their decisions about treatment respected and are not obliged to burden their family with unreasonable financial and other considerations. Only reasonable treatment is morally obligatory and the decision remains with the patient. The patient is the one who bears responsibility for the treatment. In choosing to decline further treatment, the patient is not choosing to remain ill or to die. He or she is deciding that the treatment is too burdensome and therefore not obligatory. For treatment to be justified, it must be respectful of the patient as a person, life-giving, either quality or quantity, and reasonable, dependent on the circumstances. Just one more, and then I'll pause. And still on euthanasia. That something is judged to be morally wrong does not automatically mean that there must be a law forbidding it and sanctions for contravening the law. This is the case in every field. It might be wrong, but that doesn't mean the government has to make it illegal. and put punishment attached to it. That's another consideration. What is the common good? And the common good might mean decriminalising some action, because it's not for the common good to make it a crime. It doesn't make it morally wrong, or right, if you allow it, but you don't have to intervene all the time. That's the general principle. The common good must be considered, and the bad effects of punishing immoral behaviour may outweigh its good effects. However, law does have an educative role in forming attitudes. If euthanasia is decriminalised, which some argue it should be, voluntary euthanasia may lead, and this is not pie-in-the-sky talk, it may lead to involuntary euthanasia, which is murder. How can the law defend a vulnerable patient from choosing death rather than being a burden on loved ones? So I'm in the process of dying, meaning death is becoming rather imminent. I know I'm on my last lap, sick somewhere. And what's to stop me in my vulnerable state thinking, oh, I'm too much of a burden on my daughter. She's coming every day to visit me in hospital. Do you get what I'm saying? And that concern not to be a burden might make me vulnerable to organising euthanasia out of nice, kind intentions, because I don't want to be a burden. And sometimes the children may be very neglectful of their father or their mother, and so put enormous pressure on the parent, without even maybe voluntarily doing it, to terminate this process of dying. We're not allowed to do that. We're allowed for nature to take its course, but we're not allowed to intervene for our own convenience or for any other reason and actually procure death. The lessening of the need for palliative care may appeal to some governments as saving expense. If we don't have to have palliative care, if we can empty our hospitals more quickly, there are governments that behave like this, so it's not impossible that we could do it if we're careless. So we just move people on a bit more quickly. And what will they miss out on? They're missing out on the beautiful, hopefully beautiful, or society is not providing the beautiful environment, for example, that my mother died in. Everyone should have that beautiful environment of people around them, and we're trying to do it, I hope, but everyone should be there loved, don't you think, in their last days, and able to finish off business that's there. And as a priest, I've just seen so many people transformed in that suffering period and die saints. They've learnt so much in that pain, but also their kids grow up too and start to be... So much good can come out of that, out of the loving comfort of dying well. And we could cut that in, terminate it, disrespecting the human being. Is there a danger of creating a climate of fear among the elderly and the vulnerable? So they're just some considerations on this issue of euthanasia. So we now come to what is going to prove a marathon task for me, I hope for you as well. We're going to be looking at the fifth commandment, and it covers so many critical issues of our life. I'll do some of it, then we'll have a break, and then I'll continue. So the fifth commandment looks very straightforward. Number 2258, quoting Exodus 20:13 and Deuteronomy 5:17, you shall not kill. Stop. That's it. Hebrew, a bit of information for a start. Hebrew has a number of words for kill. The verb used here is ratsach. It refers to intentional killing by use of force. It's never used in the Hebrew Bible for killing in battle. So this doesn't forbid war, literally. They never thought of that, because they had to fight for their life and all the rest of it. Nor is it ever used for killing in self-defense, this verb in Hebrew. So our thou shalt not kill is a bit wobbly in general for this command. As it occurs in the Decalogue, it directly refers only to the killing of one's neighbour. The thought of a Jew killing a Moabite would only bring delight to everybody. I mean, of course you kill Moabites if they're, you know, and you kill Ammonites and you kill Edomites and you kill Philistines and you kill anybody. But this is about your neighbour. You don't kill within the community. So it's actually quite a limited perspective that they had. The command obviously has to be broader than that. As we would expect, Jesus goes further, warning against the attitudes that lead to violence and to the taking of another person's life. So here we have a Christian perspective on the fifth commandment, which I'll now read from Matthew chapter 5. You've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, kill, ratzach. And, it also says, whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say this to you, said Jesus. He's trying to get our hearts purified, not have us all obeying certain laws and not obeying laws out there. It's not just about action. He says, I say this to you, if you're angry with your brother or sister, you'll be liable to judgment. If you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council, the local Sanhedrin. And if you say you're fool, you'll be liable to the hell of fire. Now, he's not getting one worse, one worse, one worse. It's three in a circle. In other words, all these things matter. Jesus demands avoidance of all behaviour that expresses anger and disrespect and that treats others as having no value and having nothing to offer. Being a disciple of Jesus demands purification of the heart and attitude as well as abstaining from violence against another. John, in his letter, having learned from Jesus, says, the one who hates a brother or sister is a murderer. So let's go back in a bit of the history of the Old Testament. The story of Cain and Abel, which you all know, from Genesis chapter 4. In a world where there are so many differences, it's easy to forget that we are all brothers and sisters. The world still needs to hear that. We're all from one stock. We talked about monotheism last week. There's only one God, for heaven's sake. With the one God to whom we are all responsible. Differences can easily lead to rivalry and to conflict. Human beings, according to the author of this story, often called the Yahwist, because he calls God Yahweh prior to the time of Moses, so that's a technical description. Whoever the Yahwist was is quite uncertain, but the author anyhow of this story. Human beings are persons in community. The author is interested in reality as experienced. Having reflected on human neglect of listening to God in the stories of Adam and Eve, the key sin, they didn't listen to God. Now what happens? They're not listening to each other. He goes on to reflect on another dimension of sin, violence by some people against others. Cain means Smith. He represents the town people, the people with land, the farmers, the people who've got their wells and their fields and they live in towns. And their biggest enemy were these bloomin' nomads, these shepherds that came in with their sheep and their goats and used their wells and tramped over their fields and took the green that they needed in Palestine, which is not that well watered. So you can understand a bit of rivalry, can't you? So the story of Cain and Abel is not the story about two blokes, for heaven's sake. It's a story about the shepherds and the farmers and the conflict that was endemic in that whole area. God for the Yahwist is not defined within the limits of piety or cult, but is in everything, intimately concerned for what we do and in dialogue with us. inviting us to face up to our reality and act morally. The Yahwist is fascinated by the struggle between creation and destruction, between promise fulfilled and regret as failure, a regret at failure. There's the apparent paradox that it is God's blessing, if you read the story carefully, which leads to human creativity. Cain is the father of towns, smithies, technology, all the wonderful things that happen in a town, and expansion, which in turn seems to issue in arrogance and sin and the rejection of the blessing. So that story of Cain and Abel is a story about you and me and the Middle East and America and everywhere else. It's a story about us, a life to be reflected on. And it's a, being a story, of course, it's very memorable. Matthew, how beautiful Jesus goes to this. And I want to contrast what Jesus said with what Sirach says. And my purpose in making the contrast is to help you, if you need help, read the Bible intelligently. Because if you just read Sirach and said it was the Word of God, we do that in the church. Sometimes you've heard Old Testament readings read, and then the person says the Word of the Lord, and everyone says thanks be to God, and I kind of think, well, no one's listening, because I wouldn't be thanking God for that. Some of it's dreadful stuff. So we need intelligence to sort out the real meaning of what's going on. So we'll just compare these two in a minute. Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Now what does love your enemies mean? It doesn't mean invite them to your party. It doesn't mean feel really good about them. It means pray for those who persecute you so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous alike. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Don't even the Gentiles do this? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. It doesn't mean be as perfect as God. It means let the perfection of your life, and that teleios means the goal to which you're heading, that culminates your journey, let the perfection you grow towards be the same kind of perfection you see in God. And it's the perfection of love. Let that be your goal. Let that be what you're aiming at. Watch your Father and how he treats the world, people. See it in Jesus. Well, be like that. Let that be what you're like. Now, a contrast is in Sirach, chapter 12, written 200 BC, 180 BC, by a wise Jew. If you do good, know to whom you do it, and you'll be thanked for your good deeds. Do good to the devout, and you'll be repaid, if not by them, certainly by the Most High. No good comes to one who persists in evil, and to one who doesn't give alms. So, wise, give to the devout, but don't help sinners. Do good to the humble, but don't give it to the ungodly. Hold back their bread. Don't give it to them, or by means of them, they'll subdue you. Then you'll receive twice as much evil for all the good you've done to them. For the Most High hates sinners and will inflict punishment on the ungodly. Give to the one who is good, but do not help the sinner. Wise, I suppose, normal way of thinking within a very confined little group. And he's just telling them, you know, where they stand in all this. So, you know that man who said to Jesus, who is my neighbour? He was being smart, but he also was being honest. And that was what filled his head. And then Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan who reaches out and helps the enemy. And he says, go and do that. Do likewise. So Jesus was a shock to his contemporaries. He was just stand out. He contradicted so much of their early schooling and early teaching, and he blew apart any narrowness, cultic or religious or narrowness that was in their head. And we all need that to be blown apart, because we all pretty well tend to belong to the group, and if you don't, well, look at the rest of the world. Everyone else does, so I presume we do too a bit. So it's, but Jesus just won't have it because he was a monotheist. So let's look at some of the complications then that this commandment leads to. Legitimate self-defense. This is number 2263 to 2265. But what's good about this? I'm offering you the text as in the second edition, which was got in the year 2000. The first edition, while signed off by the Pope in October, I think, 1992, was actually produced in 1994. So this is 6 years after the first edition. And in that 6 years, the Catechism, especially among the Ten Commandment area, changed, especially today, changed quite considerably. And why I love telling you that is, I'm hoping that the third edition will change a lot too. Like, it's a catechism, but people keep on thinking, don't we? And we're not talking about fundamental, absolute truths about God. The Blessed Eucharist isn't going to change, and the Trinity isn't, and the Incarnation isn't. But on these moral issues, as times change, as perception grows, as the Pope gets more ideas too, and the people around him, as we all argue and debate and encourage and see and talk, a lot of moral issues become clearer and clearer and clearer. They should, and so hopefully they will then, that will be revealed in the Catechism. So this is considerably revised in the second edition. So number 2265 reads now, legitimate defence can be not only a right, because it's about killing sometimes, so we better look at it, but a grave duty for one who's responsible for the lives of others. The defence of the common good requires that an unjust aggressor be rendered unable to cause harm, personally in the street or across the borders of a country. That's my bit added in. But for this reason, those who legitimately hold authority have the right to use arms to repel aggressors against the civil community entrusted to their responsibility. This is not first strike we're talking about. This is defence. And that's subtle. And as the world changes and as aggression changes, we have to be all more and more careful how to do this, don't we? Because war changes with each generation. But the right to defend and the duty to defend is there, even though it may involve taking life. Here we move on to the right of the state to punish civil offences. Now on the table I've left you, so this is a very complex area, and I want to advertise this. Sepp would be better to advertise it, but just, it's tonight, isn't it, Sepp? There's a, the Christians for an Ethical Society are presenting the first of a number of seminars on prisons, because Canberra's getting its own prison. So if you've got time and interest tonight, the title is Prisons, Can They Be Human, Even Rehabilitate? And the speaker is Professor Tony Vinson. And it's 7:30 tonight. I won't be able to go because I'm giving a lecture elsewhere. At the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture, Kings Avenue, Barton. You can look at it more later. But I want to look at this issue with you now, and I'm drawing on some material I got off the internet from the United States Bishops' Conference. They produce some massively good stuff. And on this, well, you'll see if you like it or not. But firstly, I'll read the Catechism, and then I'll turn to the principles involved in this whole thing of imprisonment and incarceration and what are the values that we need to have when we're talking about it. So the Catechism reads, the efforts of the state to curb the spread of behaviour harmful to people's rights and to the basic rules of civil society correspond to the requirement of safeguarding the common good. Legitimate public authority has the right and the duty to inflict punishment proportionate to the gravity of the offence, says the Catechism. Punishment has the primary aim of redressing the disorder introduced by the offence. When it's willingly accepted by the guilty party, it assumes the value of expiation. Punishment, then, in addition to defending public order and protecting people's safety, has a medicinal purpose. As far as possible, it must contribute to the correction of the guilty party. That's a general principle from the Catechism. Now I'll take you through some more detailed thoughts. One example that comes to my mind pretty readily is this business about drunken driving. And when I was a lot younger, anybody could drive, anybody could drink. There were accidents all over the place and people just drank and then shot off in their car and so on. Today, most of us, probably you, me, are very careful about drinking when we're driving. Why? Because the police might... and we might get caught and we might have to pay money, we might have to go to prison, we might have to do a whole lot of things and there's all that. So law is there to protect the society and the common good and order in the community, and we're all better off for it, I would think, aren't we? So good law comes in, and the threat of that punishment has persuaded a lot of people, not everybody sadly, to be careful in this area. That's one example. There's a lot of others, but let's look at the United States statements now. And all I can do is go through it pretty quickly with you. So this was in the year 2000, and it's called Responsibility, Rehabilitation and Restoration, A Catholic Perspective on Crime and Criminal Justice. And they quote a couple of texts from Scripture which are good. They quote the second one I've tucked in there because they didn't quote it, but I still think it's good, so I've added it. One is St. Paul, 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test everything, he says. Retain what's good and refrain from every kind of evil. That's really good, because often we use evil means to control evil, don't we? We inflict another evil to stop one evil. Romans 12:21, which I added in there, says, don't be overcome by evil. That's good. But overcome evil with good. So we've got to test to see that what we're doing is itself good. And then the texts of Jesus, which you know, I was in prison and you visited me, and then the statement of Jesus at the beginning of Luke's Gospel in the Nazareth, he has sent me to proclaim release to captives. That's got a lot of levels to it, and it's a general statement, but it's... And then the story of the Good Samaritan, the story of the prodigal son, and the story of the Last Judgment. I was in prison and you visited me. So let's look at some of the basic principles. These are straight suggested by the American Episcopacy, and I'll just read them. Protecting society from those who threaten life, inflict harm, take property, and destroy the bonds of community. We have to do that. We can't leave it rampaging around the place. So that's a duty to do that. Two, rejecting simplistic solutions as three strikes and you're out. Rigid sentencing. There was a time, maybe it's still in, when the magistrates had no room to move, no room to check on the circumstances, and a magistrate was all... Well, I might be overstating this, and if you're a magistrate, please tell me, and I hope it's still not the case. But there were politicians talking like this. More and more and more, magistrates were giving no room to move. They had to follow the law and give the worst punishment to the people without considering... That's awful, awful behaviour. But a lot of the people wanted it, because we wanted law and order. I read... what's his name? Oh, dear, I'm not going to remember it now. But I did read it in Rome, one of the things to get away from my study. And he's written plenty of novels. Oh, dear, this is stupid. But he's only written one true story, and it was about a man in America who was innocently... And the client... Who wrote that? John Grisham. Well, he's written one non-novel, and it's a hair-raising story about a man who was incarcerated for years and years on death row and was innocent. And there was trumped-up stuff, and there was, but the community on the whole didn't mind at all, because it looked like they were doing something against crime. Crimes were horrendous, but he didn't commit it. So it happens. So there's this rejecting simplistic solutions. Three, promoting serious efforts towards crime prevention and poverty reduction. If we do nothing about poverty and then incarcerate people who out of poverty commit crime, we've got it all back the front. Fourth, challenging the culture of violence and encouraging a culture of life. Fifth, these are just offering victims the opportunity to participate more fully in the criminal justice process. They're often locked out. And they might get money, they might have the pleasure, inverted commas, of seeing the person who committed the crime in prison, but they're still hurting, and no one's hearing their story, and they're still unable to get over it or grow from it. Six, encouraging innovative programs of restorative justice that provide the opportunity for mediation between victims and offenders and offer restitution for the crimes committed. There's a lot being written about that, and it's a marvellous idea. Trying to bring the perpetrator of the crime and the victim together so that they can see where they're each coming from. A lot of healing, of course it's a very skilled process, but a lot of healing can come from it. Seven, insisting that punishment has a constructive and rehabilitative purpose. These are all the principles we need to have in mind as a community. Eight, encouraging spiritual healing and the renewal for those who commit crime. There's a little statement over there also from the same website of a Catholic deacon, chaplain in Chicago at the jail, and his story about what's happened, and it's very moving, and the conversion that can happen in there, and, well, the cruelty of the community to prisoners. Number nine, making a serious commitment to confront the pervasive role of addiction and mental illness in crime. 10, treating immigrants justly. And 11, placing crime in a community context and building on promising alternatives that empower neighbourhoods and towns to restore a sense of security. It's a big article. It's about 10, 15 pages, I think, so there's a lot in it, and I've just given you a quick summary just to try to cover it. But I'll just continue with this section on the same idea of punishment of crime. This is the second edition, and this is almost entirely new, this page here. Assuming that the guilty party's identity and responsibility have been fully determined, the traditional teaching of the church does not exclude recourse to the death penalty. The traditional teaching does not exclude it. If this is the only possible way of effectively defending human rights against the unjust aggressor. There's an if there, and it's talking about tradition, but let's read the rest of it. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority will limit itself to such means, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the common good and more in conformity with the dignity of the human person. And then the Catechism, the second edition, 2000, quotes a statement by John Paul II made in 1995, the year after the Catechism was published, in his wonderful encyclical called Gospel of Life. And this was incorporated into the second edition. And here's the quote. John Paul II, "Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime by rendering one who has committed an offence incapable of doing harm, without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself, the cases in which the execution of an offender is an absolute necessity are very rare, if not practically non-existent." And since that time, 1995, in the last 10, 13 years, including another whole article over there from the American bishops, more and more and more of Catholic, not only Catholic, opinion is swaying away from the death penalty. Here's another couple of changes that have taken place. I'll give you a break in a moment. Over time, in a couple of issues related to this fifth commandment, military service. Pope Pius XII, in Christmas 1956, said, "A Catholic citizen may not appeal to his conscience as grounds for refusing to serve and fulfil duties fixed by civil law." That's 50 years ago, statement from the Pope, and since it's not an infallible statement, obviously, but it's high authority, and that would have been taken very seriously by teachers who taught me, taught you, and general Catholic theology. Look what the Vatican Council said in 10 years later. "Laws should make humane provision for the case of conscientious objectors who refuse to carry arms, provided they accept some other form of community service." That's a sea change in perception, through thinking, through awareness, through people like yourselves arguing, through intelligent people debating what the Pope had said, and the Pope was wrong. Well, the awareness grew. Here's another one, use of nuclear weapons. "Many bishops, especially in the United States, strongly supported the use of nuclear arms. Many lay people opposed it. It was their insights which led to a development in church teaching." And Vatican II says this now. "Any act of war aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities or extensive areas along with their population is a crime against God and humanity. It merits unequivocal, unhesitating condemnation." I don't know, you can be tougher than that and stronger than that. And just think, my own brother in the Air Force, Second World War, had to go over Germany bombing Lancaster, whole cities, dams, and indiscriminately killing people. And war's got worse since, hasn't it? War used to be about disarming the opposition and reducing their power. Now war seems to have become, step two, having disarmed your power, we then, the ones who win, go in and kill men, women, children, people, because the children are going to grow up one day and be against it. So you've got to wipe them out. That's what's happening, aren't we? Wiping out peoples, lest they... And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Now we indiscriminately, some people go in and just blow up market squares and kill innocent people in God's name. So international law... Anyhow, so I'll conclude this first part of with this statement on... homicide. It's just my comments and then we'll finish. "It is wrong to do anything that is intended directly to bring about someone's death. Principle of twofold effect is a basic principle of moral theology. If my intention is to cause your death, that's never right. It's also wrong to do something that is intended indirectly to result in another person's death, such as inducing a famine, reducing people to desperate poverty by trade injustices, forcing migration, engineering a situation that results in the death of a certain group of people. I'm doing something which will inevitably cause your death. That's also never allowed. Sometimes, however, we intend to do one thing, but what we do has the effect of killing another, and we regret that. Many factors must be considered here. But it's not always wrong to do something that is good and necessary, even if it means taking another person's life. An obvious example is the case of defending oneself or another against unjust aggression, because our actions have more than one result. There's a little child there, and you're crazy, you're over on drugs, and you're bearing down on this little kid for reasons I don't understand with a knife, And I just can't sit there and say a Hail Mary. So I don't know what I'd do, to be quite honest, but I'd hope I would intervene. And the only way I might be able to intervene finally is by taking this person's life, because they're just all over and they're aggressing. You've just got to... whatever. Our intention is to stop aggression, not to take the life of the aggressor. But the situation is such that we cannot defend against aggression without killing the aggressor. If this were not morally justified, we would all be passive victims of those who have no regard for the rights of others.